Welcome to the State Library of New South Wales and to the Lunchtime Talk with Bruce Pascoe. Thank you for joining us today. I begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we and this library stand, the Gadigal of the Eora Nation, and pay my respects to their elders, past and present. We are delighted to have Bruce join us today. Bruce Pascoe, a Bunurong man, is a member of a Wathaurong Aboriginal Cooperative of Southern Victoria and an award-winning Australian writer, editor, and anthologist. His works have been published nationally and internationally and have won several national literary competitions. Bruce will talk about his book, Dark Emu, Black Seeds, Agriculture or Accident today. His book was a joint winner of the 2016 Indigenous Writers Prize of the New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards, and it also won the 2016 New South Wales Book of the Year. Before Bruce begins, I would like to read to you a comment from the judges about Bruce's book. This vital book wrestles with Australia's ideas about itself and its oldest traditions. Dark Emu injects a profound authenticity into the conversation about how we Australians understand our continent. Pascoe demonstrates with convincing evidence, often from early explorers' journal, that the Aboriginal people lived settled and sophisticated lives here for millennia before Cook arrived. Passionately and with great love, Pascoe builds a picture of a shared future in Australia based on the traditions which sustained the Aboriginal nations for so long, respectful human cooperation across political borders, and knowledgeable, sustainable care of the natural world. Dark Emu is essential reading for anyone who wants to understand what Australia once was, or what it might yet be if we heed the lessons of long and sophisticated human occupation. This talk is part of the State Library's Going Places Authors on Tours project, which is generously supported by the Copyright Agency Cultural Fund. The book is available for sale in the library bookshop after the event. But now please join me in welcoming Bruce to the stage.
I would also like to acknowledge the Gadigal land and of the Eora Nation, not just as a matter of form, but because I love the land and I appreciate being able to walk upon it and talk on it. I appreciate the invitation from the State Library, but also the willingness of elders in the City of Sydney the last few days who have welcomed me to their country. I think it's a fantastic time to be an Australian. Yesterday I was in Blacktown Library addressing library people out there at Blacktown, and it's a long way out there, and I appreciate the fact that the library and Copyright Agency Limited had provided the funds to send writers out to remote parts of Sydney. I mean, it does sound daggy, but it's remote out there, and I think it's just fantastic that all Australians get the opportunity to do things like this, not just in the centre of the city. Anyway, so I'm appreciative of the library and all the great help that I've had from Mandy and library staff for many, many years. I'm upgrading this PowerPoint. I haven't been able to get this couple of new pictures on, but the young man called Jonathan Jones, who's speaking over at UTS at the moment, he read Dark Emu when it first came out in 2014 and went on to go to the National Museum in Canberra, and he asked them if he could, as an archaeology student, if he could look at these stone tools in their collection. Virtually none of them were on display. Most had never been on display. And in the basement, he came across crates and crates of stones this large. They were heavy at one end, pointed at the other, and he did a scientific survey of these stones, weighing each of them and looking at the haft marks on the stone. They had been tied onto a handle using kangaroo sinew, which, when it dries out, dries so strongly that it actually makes an impression on the stone itself. the Aboriginal manufacturers of this axe, of this implement, had chiselled a channel for the kangaroo tendon to go in, but the whole effect would have been incredible strength and durability. And after having done the survey, Jones then realised that these were impossible to use above your waist because they're so heavy. So, in fact, the vertical handle allowed those stones to be used between the legs in a pendulum action, and in fact, they were a pick. Aboriginal people were using a pick to turn over the soil. This turns Australian history on its head. Just that one fact found out by a young Aboriginal man, Jonathan Jones, Wiradjuri man, I'm so proud of him, that he didn't accept the history that he'd been taught in school. He went and had another look. And all Australians will learn to be grateful to that young man. The idea that Aboriginal people turned the soil is revolutionary. I talk about it in Dark Emu, but there's more to come. There's much more to come. In Warrnambool, about 5 weeks ago, an archaeological survey was conducted of a large midden there. The local Gunditjmara people, the Kerapjmara, and even the Wathaurong, 30 years ago, were asking the authorities to examine that midden because it was so old it had turned into stone. It was an indication that it was a really old midden. And we'd been waiting for a long time for this midden to be examined. When I went to school, the length of occupation of Aboriginal people on the continent of Australia was 10,000 years. You know, admittedly, I went to school a long time ago, but almost immediately, by the time I got to high school, that had risen to 15,000 years. By the time I got to university, it was 40,000 years as a result of carbon dating. What they didn't tell us at university was carbon dating can only measure to 40,000 years, after which the carbon isotope has disappeared. So 40,000 years was the minimum. When I met one of the archaeologists on that dig at Warrnambool, I said to her, isn't it great that that's come up with an age of 60,000 years? And she said, no, it's 80,000 years. That happens to be 10,000 years before out of Africa, before the first people were supposed to have left Africa. Now, the proponents of the out of Africa theory have begun revisiting it, not because, you know, the DNA tests they did were wrong. It's just that the assumptions taken from those tests are not really explaining what had been going on in the world. And what had the movements in South America aren't consistent with that theory. So it's going to be revisited. But the point of it all is that Aboriginal people have been saying all along, we have always been here. And in the past, Aboriginal people have been patted on the head. Oh, you wise black man, you know, and condescended to, you know, oh, that's your belief, isn't it? Quaint. And it's turning out to be more right than wrong every day. As well as that, Australian archaeologists have been, once they leave university, have been flocking to Egypt to study the pyramids. And they need another study, like Macbeth needs another critical review. one of my really good friends, an archaeologist from up around the Mildura area, she's always complained to me that her best students end up in Egypt or Africa, and she wants them to stay here because she was studying a village in the Willandra Lakes area which had channels dug in it so canoes could be drawn up outside of every house. It sounds like Venice. It's a beautiful concept, and we still have not finished the examination of that. Because they flooded it to build a dam. Now, we do need a lot of water, but it could have done with a little bit more care to study that. So that edge ground axe that they discovered in Western Australia only a matter of weeks ago and examined, that turned out to be 50,000 years. This is older than any other tool of its type in the world. So there'd been a lot of technological development in Australia to the point where this was the most advanced stone tool technology in the world. And when Norman Tyndale suggested as much in the 70s and 80s when he was here, he was literally laughed out of the country by Australian archaeologists and historians who thought that he was gilding the lily, making too much of Aboriginal achievement. And now that axe proves him to be exactly right. And we're grateful to those Australian archaeologists who did the work to find that stone and measure its age, because it's a very important fact. It supports what our old people have always been saying. We have always been here. And 2 years ago, two archaeologists discovered a grinding dish that they measured as being 35,000 years old, and it had been used to grind grain into flour to make bread. So that woman who did that had done it very, very early in the world's history. And I started to Google bread, and just as I'd gone through a typical Australian education, so I was thinking bread must have been discovered somewhere else, right? So I was Googling bread, and I discovered that the Egyptians were the first in the world to make bread 17,000 years ago. So Our Lady at Cuddy Springs, that brilliant woman, was 15,000 years before anyone else on earth. We know it was a woman because that was the grinding the grain was a woman's occupation. But not only had she ground grain into flour, she'd invented the scientific experiment of bread making. So she had taken the flour, she'd applied water to it, a chemical combination, and then applied heat to the result. It's great science, and she was the first person to do it. So when Australians are worrying about their identity, you know, worrying whether perhaps Sir Donald Bradman was the best person on earth. In fact, he wasn't even the best stockbroker on earth. And when we're worrying about the world not enjoying Vegemite sufficiently, or remembering that we invented the stump jump plough, I'd like Australians, when they're overseas, to say, I come from the country that invented bread, and I'm proud. It'd be a lovely thing to say, and it would bring the country together. There is so much more of this material to come. I'd love to be able to show you the picture of that stone. I had it up on my computer this morning, and I was just looking at this image thinking that Australian school students over the next 3 or 4 years are going to see that as a mighty icon of Australian excellence and Australian ingenuity. This is Mount Goongra, up past Cabbage Tree Creek in Far East Gippsland. And these are the eggs of the rainbow serpent. This is not just a quaint story. You know, oh, isn't that interesting? The rainbow serpent laid its eggs, which are actually granite stones. These are representations, of course, as is every religious belief in the world, a representation. But the importance of this, this is the snake's song line that goes virtually right around Australia, and it is paralleled out at sea by the whale song line. And we're stitching together that the whale song line, and we're taking young Aboriginal people with us from Hervey Bay to Rottnest Island, right down past the coast of Tasmania, bringing together the song line. It binds three quarters of Australia together in one unit, and we're hoping that that this will become the Carmina Burana of Australian tourism, not because of the dollars, but because of the spirit, to learn about our country and learn to love our country and respect our country. So that's why I put up those. When I was researching a dark emu, I'd been told by some senior Australian academics that using the word Aborigine in the same sentence as agriculture was just pulling the wool over Australian eyes. But the more I looked, the more evidence I found for it. And the Rural Institute for Research and Development compiled a map using Norman Tyndale's discoveries of where Aboriginal people had grown grain and compared it to the current Australian wheat belt. The current wheat belt for Australia is in southwestern Western Australia, in that egg shape there, and on the southeast corner near the New South Wales border, right down into Victorian South Australia. But where Tyndale saw and recorded Aboriginal people growing grain is the dark black line area, which is four times the size. So all those years ago, Aboriginal people were harvesting grain over a much larger area of Australia. In fact, Charles Sturt, when he was near the Cooper's Creek, he was nearly dead. Some of his fellows had died. A lot of the horses had died. Horses were so weak, he said, they could only stagger in a straight line. And they'd been going up and down sandhills. They all had scurvy, and they were in their last days. And on one last sand dune, they looked down into a riverbed and were hailed by 350 Aboriginal people. And those people came forward and gave the men and the horses water. Then they fed them roast duck and cake they'd made from their own flour and gave the explorers a house to live in their town. Words like house, town, bread, these were unknown to me when I went through university. And these are the terms we have to use in front of our children. These are not indecent words. These are what the explorers witnessed. This is their witness of what Aboriginal people were doing. And so it's not blasphemy. It's not a black armband theory. It's what our explorers, the most revered historians in our history, that's what they saw. That's what they recorded. They wrote it down and we've ignored it. Our educational institutions have ignored it. And we could go into why it was ignored, but it's a combination of facts. One of them is that calling Aboriginal people hunters and gatherers is a convenient way of explaining why the land had to be taken from them. But also, the explorers were paid to look for grass and water. They weren't paid to look for Aboriginal people. So 9/10 of their journals were about grass and water and not about the lives of Aboriginal people who were already living there. So that has obviously had an impact on the education of our children. But also, as each generation goes by, we're taught by people who have been taught that story and they go on to teach other people. And they're not axe murderers. They're people who believe in what they've been taught by their teachers. We have to change what we teach our teachers. At Lake Mungo, 18 months ago, the ladies at Lake Mungo, in combination with a Japanese travelling student, decided to harvest a grain that they'd been growing, that had been growing in Lake Mungo. It hadn't been harvested for 200 years, but those women decided it had to be done. And so they worked with that Japanese student and their own young people to grind that grain into flour. And it was an historic moment because no one had made bread from that flour for 200 odd years. And the Japanese guy worked with the students to create these solar ovens. In the centre of the alfoil, you see a little basin down the bottom with the bread in it. And we sat in the sand dunes there with a bit of music playing and a bit of history of the Lake Mungo area while the bread was cooking. And you could smell it cooking. It was the thing about this panicum flower is that it gives off such a wonderful aroma. It smells like a summer grain field. It's just beautiful. You know how onions can take over a kitchen? Well, the smell of this can take over a kitchen because we're cooking, not with this, but we're cooking with kangaroo grass flour at home. And every time we do it, the house smells beautiful for 2 days, even though we've got 3 dogs. And there's the bread. And those old girls were just bawling by the time this came out of those ovens. And I'm not ashamed to say I would join them because it was an historic moment, because we'll be eating this bread in not too distant future. One of the reasons being is that that grain needs no more water than our country, Australia, can provide. We don't have to treat it like a plant from Devon or France. This grows in Australia. It has been domesticated by Aboriginal people. It has adapted to Australian soils and climate, and it's resistant to Australian pests. It's perfect. And the other grass that we're growing, kangaroo grass, it is a perennial plant. Most of these are perennials. You don't have to plough your land. They're already there, and they'll be there into perpetuity. So in terms of CO2 emissions, to not plough the land as much as we've done in the past will help us a lot to meet our reductions. And the kangaroo grass it's like an iceberg. What you see above the ground is about an eighth of what is below. So this is a massive root mass. It holds the land together. It taps moisture and minerals from way down in the soil. And the farmer, even though he's not going to get as big a crop as he's going to get of wheat, say, he doesn't have to plough his land. There's an enormous saving. There's enormous environmental saving there as well. This is a wonderful plant to have. And Aboriginal people domesticated, and you know, we're going to be eating its flower in 3 or 4 years. At Mallacoota in January of this coming year, we're going to harvest about 300 acres of kangaroo grass at the Mallacoota airport. They don't know about it yet, but we'll break the news to them gently the morning before. Bill Gammage was spoken about earlier today in a conversation I was having with some of you. And this photograph of a painting was sent to Bill Gammage by an art gallery operator in New South Wales, Eugene von Gerard's Kangatong. Kangatong is just north of Healesville. The year's 1841, so what's that, 5 years after Batman and Faulkner went to Melbourne. And this is the arrival of the first cattle into that area. That's what the painting's about. In the back left-hand corner, there's a sea of yellow. What's that? You know, if no European crops had been there before, what's that? Well, it turns out that it's Murnong, yam daisy, Microceris lanceolata. And this is the plant that Sir Thomas Mitchell saw in his Australia Felix when he climbed the Grampians, or Garryward. He looked westward, and to the horizon it was a sea of yellow flowers. And this was a combination of Murnong, Bulbine Lily and Moth Orchid. And Aboriginal people had been growing those through a bed of moss and progressively tilling them. George Augustus Robinson watched women walk across that same plain in systematically lifting up the soil, extracting the new Murnong plant, and then putting them in their baskets, and then stamping back on the plant, putting it back into the soil with its parent tuber so that it would bring on another young tuber the following season. And they did that in a line, walking steadily, and brought back to the camp that night as many as they could carry in on their backs in these beautifully woven bags. If you go to Hall's Gap, you'll see some of those bags there for sale. They're absolutely gorgeous, hand woven, hand dyed, beautiful baskets. These are Murnong that I grew myself. I've been growing them now for 5 or 6 years. And you can see on the right hand side is the mother tuber, and it is shriveling, but she's provided us with the two new tubers, and Aboriginal people made a habit of taking only one and putting the rest back into the soil for next year. And you can see the identifying tooth mark of a bush rat on the middle tuber. I've had to totally enclose that garden because I've got a few Australian pests at home. Wombats, lyrebirds, bowerbirds, chooks, bush rats, swamp rats, wombats, you know, the whole smorgasbord. They all love these things. In fact, the bush rats will walk past strawberries, ripe strawberries, to eat those. They dig them up and have a crack at them. And people say to me, why can't we see Murnong in Australia today? Well, when E.M. Kerr was taking his carts to select land, you know, we still use words like select. The true word is actually take land up around Wangaratta area. He noticed that his cartwheels were turning over bushels of these little tubers, bushels of them. This is how intense the agricultural work was being done, that he was just seeing every cartwheel was turning up bushels of these little tubers. And the sheep that were following behind the carts just hoed into all this beautiful food. They're 8 times as nutritious as a potato, Murnong. And what Kerr noticed over the next few years was the sheep learnt to nose the tubers out of the ground, because the other thing he noticed was that you could run your fingers through the soil. It was that light. There's a symbiotic relationship between the plant and the soil, which provides us enormous tilth. That combined with continuous harvesting created this fine tilth. When the sheep ate out all the Murnong, and those that they didn't nose out of the ground, their teeth allowed them to snip off the greenery right down to the head of the tuber, and that killed it overnight. So sheep, in effect, eliminated the plant from most of Australia. But not only that, their sharp hooves compacted the soil. So where the sheep had been, that fine tilth of the soil disappeared, runoff began, and Australia experienced erosion for the first time on that scale. When I was a kid, the Mallee blew across our house in Faulkner every summer. Such a disgraceful way to treat the soil. We were misusing that soil, and feet of soil disappeared in years. At Wangaratta University, a farmer told me almost as an aside and with a laugh in his voice that he, in his time on his land in the last 30 years, had lost 2.5 foot of soil. We're not using this soil very wisely. You know, our children are going to condemn us for our use of the soil. This is my son's yam garden at Warrnambool from 2 summers ago. This is, at the time, it was probably the largest plantation of Murnong or yam in Australia. I'm very proud of my boy to have gone to the trouble to do that, to want to do it, because he's a busy lad, plays a lot of sport, got a girlfriend, and she's lovely. And so it's a busy life, you know. I'm not saying she's soaking up too much of his time. I'm just saying he's normally busy, like all of us, and yet he's gone to the trouble of doing this. And that experiment has been incredibly profound. And a fortnight ago, a young man from South Australia, non-Aboriginal man, had been experimenting with Murnong, and he'd heard me talk about the application of superphosphate to the soil and how it had ruined soil fertility in some parts of Australia, but it also killed the Murnong. So he grew a plantation of Murnong, not quite as large as that, and he put superphosphate on half of it and was dead in 2 days. So that has proven that this is one of the things that got rid of the Murnong in our continent today. I was also told that superphosphate under some conditions leaches out to fluoride or fluorine. I'm not really sure which one it is, but anyway, it's what gives cattle bloat. And they've known about this for about 15 years, that if you're not careful with the application of superphosphate, you will bloat your cattle. And, you know, bloat normally kills a cow. So I don't know where I was going with that, apart from to say that, you know, perhaps we should be looking at how we apply artificial fertilisers in the country. Lovely picture from the Powerhouse Museum. This was taken at Brewarrina. And I'm taking a pretty broad brush stroke to Australian history today, but some scientists believe that the fish traps in Brewarrina are the oldest human construction on Earth. I said that fairly quickly. The oldest human construction on Earth. We spend a lot of time in Egypt looking at the pyramids, which are not quite 2,000 years old. These are at least 45,000 years old. And some say they're 55, 60,000 years old, which puts them way beyond the early buildings of Persia and places like that. But the sad thing about it is the fish in the front lad's right hand has never been seen since those days, because that fish bred at the very top of that river system, which is the Darling River, and the river was dammed. The fish traps were destroyed so paddle steamers could go past them, but further up the river was dammed and that fish could never breed again. It's gone. Look at the size of it. Part of what I learned in school, high school, university, and ever since is that Aboriginal people didn't live under anything more advanced than a piece of bark propped up by a stick. And part of my family, the white side of my Pascoe family, come from Lockhart River. These are buildings that were built at Lockhart River and were photographed, I think, in 1890, around that era. But it shows the construction using jungle vine, and then the whole is covered in grass. In Victoria, we use exactly the same design, but we began the foundation with stone, finished it off with bush poles, and then covered the entire arrangement in sods of earth that were about that deep, and then covered that with clay and straw, so that the resultant building was very strong, and very warm in winter, very cool in summer. They were beautiful buildings. And Sir Thomas Mitchell, when riding through such villages further north, on the Darling River and the Barwon River on the New South Wales-Queensland border, he remarked on how these villages that he was passing through, and he did it day after day, accommodated about 1,000 people each. The houses accommodated about 15 people each. One in Victoria accommodated 55 people because one of the people who went there to take up land was invited into a meeting, into a room where there were 54 other people. It's like a town hall. And yet, why didn't we teach that to our kids? I didn't learn it. So we need to rejuvenate that part of our brain. One of the other signifiers of civilization is how you treat the dead. And I would add how you treat the infirm. My grandson is on the autism spectrum, and the way that poor lad is being made to jump through hoops to justify getting the attention of an extra teacher for half a day a week is just a disgrace. You know, we're supposed to have the disability system paid for fully, but every politician ever since it came through has backtracked from it. This is a graveyard. This comes from Blandowski, a drawing of a graveyard. I'm just always taken by the serenity of it and the manicured nature of the area. And those white bowls, they're called widow caps. They're made out of gypsum. And they were part of the grieving process, but they also constitute Australian pottery. Now, this is a stone building which was uncovered in the fires at Tirundara in 2009, and it too would have been finished with a beehive-shaped dome of poles and grass. These are the houses that were capable of holding a family of a dozen people, and there would be many hundreds of those houses for these villages. This is in the Western District of Victoria. The day I saw that, I was with a lady called Margie Cooper, and her grandmother was born in a house very close to this one. And there's other examples. This is out of Sturt's diary. More examples of Aboriginal cemeteries, the care and grace, the serenity of that graveyard. The trees in the background have all been painted, carved. The grave itself, in the dome in the foreground, has that beautiful circle around it like the rings of Saturn. The paths that weave through the cemetery have all been clipped and manicured. It's an indication of a people not only at peace with themselves, but at peace with death and revering those who have gone before them. I find them incredibly moving. And I was very grateful to the librarian at the La Trobe Library in Melbourne, who knew that I'd been visiting the library and came out and got me and said, come on, I want to show you this book. You know, and for a bookie sort of a bloke like me, to be shown a book by a librarian is a lovely thing. But this is the book I saw. I was absolutely flabbergasted. I'd read the facsimile edition. I'd never seen this before. It's one of the wonders of Australia. These are more examples of Aboriginal housing. These are from the central western desert. And the shape is similar, but they're much lower. The doors are much smaller. And part of that is because of they're trying to keep the building dark and cool, but also to keep flies out. Because every dairy farmer knows that as long as you put your ventilation down low, you won't get flies in your dairy, because they won't fly low and they won't fly into the dark. So if you can keep the light level down and the air ventilation low, you'll keep the flies out. Try it at home. These are the ones, houses that were more commonly seen around Sydney. And the one on the right-hand side is typical of that style of building, where it's like an egg that's had a segment shaved off it, and that allows for a veranda over the front area. And once again, compare the size of the people to the size of the building, and you can see that they're not small buildings. And there's a remarkable book. A mere $35. And Father's Day coming up. And that's my most recent book, Mrs. Whitlam. It's not about the lady. It's about my wife's horse, who was always, because she was big and beautiful, she was called Mrs. Whitlam too. And there's about 8 family stories in that. And one of them was about my son, the same man who did the Murnong, who saved a child's life when he was 9. Not through any great physical strength, but through brains. Not a bad lad. What about some questions, eh?
There has been a bit of controversy regarding the archaeology on which you have relied with your talk and somewhat condescending attitude that some indigenous people have towards the archaeology done in the past. Is that a valid viewpoint?
I don't think it is. I'm not sure that I've understood the question, but right. I've had very few academics query the material, because it comes from explorers' diaries. I had someone write to me saying they thought I had Sturt's position incorrect in the book, and I did. I was 70 kilometres out, and all of it was red sandhills. But I had made a mistake, And simply because after Sturt had been given the roast duck and cake in the house, he turned around the next day. It looks from his journal as if he goes on, but he doesn't. He turns around. So we've actually made a scale error in that. But sorry, could you ask the other part of your question again?
Right. You have relied very much on the archaeological evidence that has been unearthed in the recent past and also in the past. And yet the Aboriginal people beliefs have been based on their beliefs.
Mm.
So the two have not been compatible until they were stated like you have today. Mm. Is that a valid viewpoint?
Yeah. And one of the good examples that I do mention in Dark Emu is Heather Bulth, who refused to believe the Victorian Archaeological Survey when they studied the houses at Lake Condar, similar to the house that I showed there from Tirundara. And Bulth just thought it was impossible that those stone arrangements at Lake Condar hadn't been created by people. But she couldn't convince the Victorian Archaeological Survey. So she did the extraordinary thing and she weighed all the stones. And with a mathematical formula that I don't understand, I failed Form 3 arithmetic, she proved that it couldn't have been done by accident. It had to have been done by human hand. So once that had been proven, then you have to ask the question, why? Why had humans done it? And then, of course, it's not too far to go to find that these were houses made by people beside eel traps that ranged through that country for thousands of kilometres. So in the past, a lot of the archaeology that was done was brilliant, but some of it was very condescending towards Aboriginal people and not serving the country very well. Because when you do science, you're supposed to be undertaking an experiment to look for the truth, not to back up your own opinion.
It seems horribly clear that a whole lot of terribly important stuff from the explorers' diaries was suppressed.
Mm.
Has anyone done any research to find out how that happened and why? I mean, we all know that, you know, people have wanted to prove that it was Terra Nullius, but did it go so far back that when explorers' diaries were published, things were cut out?
That's correct, because when the people who had funded the expeditions were usually local societies in Melbourne and Sydney or Adelaide, and what they'd been looking for was grass and water. And sometimes they cut out everything that wasn't about grass and water, but also deliberately cut out mention of Aboriginal people. In fact, Lieutenant Gray's journal, which talks about him finding these yam fields in Western Australia that had been so deeply tilled he couldn't walk across them, someone failed to find that in the journals. We knew it was there, but they couldn't find it in the journals until they found the original journal. And that was the only thing. A page and a half had been left out of that journal and that was it. Now, it could have been malice, could have been an accident, but look, we're just going to beat ourselves over the head if we worry about what it was. It's what we do now, this very day. Next time someone invites you to join an intervention, ask them why. Why do you send in the army when you could send in a doctor and a teacher and a nurse? We still haven't done that. The communities with really poor health still haven't had that support. Well, you know, it's much more exciting to send in the army. When all that money was being spent on Aboriginal housing up at Maningrida, all the money was expended before one Aboriginal person got a house, because all the houses were for school teachers and policemen.
Bruce, Kate Smith, leader of Slow Food Sydney, is there a way that we can work with you to get that recognition internationally of Australia being the makers of the first bread?
I'd, I'd love to do that. There's going to be quibbles from people talking about was flatbread flatbread, was risen bread the real bread. But, you know, we quite happily refer to Lebanese bread as bread. You know, it's bread as far as I'm concerned. And we also, we need to do a lot of research into whether a rising agent was used, because we believe that fermented honey was used as a kind of yeast to provide the a bit of rising in these breads. We haven't proven that yet. When I'm saying to young Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal students, this morning at UTS, three private school kids, young Aboriginal kids, gave a short dissertation. You know, and I'm saying to kids like that, you know, it's wonderful to be a lawyer because you get a BMW automatically, apparently. It's wonderful to be a doctor because you get a Volvo. Get a Volkswagen instead and be a historian. And I just love those kids to, you know, find out what was the plant that made the flower that Mitchell ate, that Sturt ate. You know, what are the names of these things? What are their potential in world terms? And a lot of Aboriginal people are a bit worried when I go around and talk like this because they, having lost the land once, they're afraid of losing it twice. And it is a real concern because people might acknowledge the Aboriginal plants but then race off, put them under horticulture and sell them to Coles. You know, and Aboriginal people will miss out again. And there's recent form here because when Europeans first came to Australia, they detested abalone. They called it mutton fish and fed it to pigs. Aboriginal people had been using that as a staple food on the south coast and west coast of Western Australia. And in the Depression, I've heard heart-wrenching stories of people who brought their children up on bimbla, which is a cockle, and abalone. That's how they survived the Depression. I remember my mum and dad talking about the Depression, how hard it was. But for Aboriginal people being at the very bottom of the pile, there were no jobs and no support. So they brought their children up on abalone. When the Chinese and the Japanese discovered that we had abalone over here and they had already destroyed their own fishery in a wanton act of very poor management, all the licences were handed out to non-Aboriginal people. And the last one in Mallacoota sold for $13 million. Aboriginal people didn't get one. My cousin's nephew is in jail for poaching abalone. Now, I think of that magistrate who was standing in front of that lad. He was 18 years old. And I just think of that magistrate's brain and think, wouldn't you just say, now, hang on, there's a point of law here that we need to investigate. And, you know, we need some of our young lads to pull their heads in a bit, but we don't need them to go to jail for that. And we, you know, maybe it's the time to make sure that 30% of the licences go to Aboriginal people. You know, we're a very wealthy country, the wealthiest in the world, and you've only got to watch the news at night to be so thankful you live here. You know, it doesn't matter who you are, Aboriginal, Syrian, non-Aboriginal, you know, you wake up in the morning and you're blessed in this country. We're so wealthy, and an act like that would be an act of grace, not an act of economic ruin.
We've always been led to believe that Indigenous people lived a nomadic lifestyle which seemed fairly appropriate to their so-called hunting and food gathering. But if, as you say, they were agriculturalists who had fairly substantial dwellings, is this nomadic lifestyle a bit of a furphy as well?
There's a blend because Aboriginal people didn't have fences either. So a lot of these plantations were enormous and covered several language areas. So people were cooperating to plant and harvest these things. So there was a bit of movement around. And when the grain season was finished, another season would begin. So there'd be just as, you know, all of the people in corporate Australia have their houses at Portsea, Aboriginal people also had a second village where they were maybe taking advantage of the eel fishery in the winter months, as against the yam and the grains in the summer months. So there was movement, but not as much as we'd been told. And it certainly wasn't hapless wandering. That's a phrase from my first form history text in Australia, hapless wandering. There was nothing hapless about it.
Yeah, thanks for a very interesting talk, Bruce. You touched on out of Africa or alternatives. Could you expand on that somewhat?
The maths is so dense, I don't really understand it. All I know is that scientists around the world are re-examining the data, not because the data is wrong, but because the assumption taken from the data doesn't seem to be explaining what actually happened. The theory goes, or went, because most people are now using a different model, but it went that everyone is descended from one African mother, according to DNA, and that gradually people left Africa and crossed, I think, the Red Sea and made their way to other continents that way, across to Asia and down to Australia. And that happened, began happening 70,000 years ago. But it now looks like the Aboriginal claim that we have always been here is more right than wrong. And the assumption was always that Aboriginal people had come from somewhere else. But maybe, and in the paper today, the age of a life on Earth has been pushed back further again. You know, every time scientists look at a thing, they refine their research results. And this is going to keep on going. In the last 18 months, the amount of new material that's come out of Australian archaeology is a reflection of the number of Australian archaeologists working all of a sudden. And so every year we're getting these new data. You know, we've examined half a dozen grinding dishes out of the thousands and thousands and thousands that are available. When we start examining a few more of those, it's inevitable we'll come up with an older date. The same with the stone axe. There are many, many hundreds of stone axes in museums around the country. When we do a real search, when we let the Jonathan Joneses loose to do this research, we're going to get older ages again. So the theory now is that there were several strands of human development happening concurrently around the world and not following necessarily the same pattern as the out of Africa theory. I'm not a good person to ask about it. I do mention it only to point out that Aboriginal people have a different opinion.
That's all we've got time for this afternoon. I think we could all join in and say thank you very much, Bruce, for that insightful, amazing talk.